Go loud.
Watch your waiting for? Watch your back in it? Just a little more. Throw your whip in it now. Fill your body up tight. Walk it hard and slow. When you finish that,
deep knocker.
Go down, go down, go down.
Episode number 180 of the Talking Bollocks podcast, brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, CLB.
It's me, Teddy Flower.
And today we're joined by
Austin O'Carroll.
So Austin, do you want to tell us what do you do?
So me, what do? I'm a GP working in the inner city Dublin, but I have four more or less jobs. I run a GP practice, which is an inner city practice. I also work a lot with homeless. I've developed a lot of services for homeless people and migrants, GP services. I also run a GP two GP training programs, and I was also recently appointed the chairperson of the North Inner City Drugs Task Force. So
brilliant.
That's what I'm doing at the moment.
Class. Right, so Austin, what we do with every guest is, will you take us back to the start, tell us where you're from and what was life like growing up for you?
Okay, me, I was born and raised in... it's on the border of Stillorgan and Black Rock. It's technically Black Rock, but I always tell people Stillorgan because I'm slightly embarrassed about the Black Rock connection. My mother, before I was born, took thalidomide, you know, the drug. It's this drug that causes babies to be born with short limbs. And she only took it twice, but I was born with basically, when I was born, I had a very short lower limb and I had also abnormal hands. And then I spent 5 years because the lower, below my knee, basically, the bones weren't knitting together, so I couldn't walk. So I spent 5 years undergoing operations trying to knit them. And they also, my upper limbs were shortened, but they stretched my bones. I think they got it a bit long, actually, myself. And they stretched them. My upper limbs are now normal length, but I've got these abnormal thumbs. And then around the age of five, so I spent most of my first 5 years in and out of hospital, in hospital, most of it. So that's most of my memories from 0 to 5. And then when I got to five, I could walk at that stage. So there I went home and I was at home only a few months when my mother was upstairs painting and she left me downstairs and I decided to go up and watch her. So I was climbing up the stairs and anyway, I fell down the stairs, broke both the legs, back in. They straightened the leg and I was sent home, told not to play football. I went and played football. They came back. The doctor said I have to re-straighten it. So I got it. When they re-straighten it, they basically break it and redo it again. So that happened to me 5 or 6 times between the age of 5 and 13. So I was in and out of hospital. Now, when I say I was in and out of hospital, I still also was out in the road playing with the kids when I was in between. And then were the days when there was, you know, there was crowds of kids in the street. And it was good fun being a kid those days.
Mm.
So, you know, it isn't that I have all bad memories. I have lots of really good memories of and been with the family and been on the street and having crack and playing football and playing... was a pussy four corners and, you know, sick, dying, dead, all those street games. So, yeah, that was my early life.
What was school like for you?
School was grand. I mean, I got a bit of slagging early on because of the size. But I used to have these metal calipers, you know, which go down and fit into your thing. And basically a kick with one of those soon stopped anyone calling me names. But I wasn't allowed to play sports because I couldn't run or anything like that. So a lot of times, you know, I still love school. But then I got basically into doing things like I played a lot of chess. I got into doing things like public speaking and writing magazines. So in fact, it forced and playing table tennis. It got me to do other stuff. So I went to a Christian Brother School, Oatlands, you know, all the way through Oatlands right up to Leaving Cert. And so I had good times in school. I really enjoyed it. I had good crack.
Did you always want to get into medicine?
I always wanted to get into medicine. From early on, I decided because I wanted to get into medicine. Everyone asks me, you know, is that because I was in hospital? And to be honest, I don't think so because I hate hospitals and I used to hate the smell of them. My memories, you know, that stuff they put in your leg, the iodine type and the smell of that was just, I hated it. But I liked working with people and I used to work a lot at the Scouts and we used to do things like helping people going off and painting old folks' houses. So I always liked doing that. So I think that's where I decided I wanted to do medicine. But I don't know if when I originally went to apply to do medicine, I got enough points to do medicine. But doctors told me I wouldn't be able to do medicine because I'm not able to walk very far. And they said I wouldn't be able to walk around the hospitals. And also they said because of my hands, I wouldn't be able to take bloods or put in, you know, IVs and things like this. So I ended up not doing medicine first. I did law for 2 years. And will I tell you what happened then?
Keep going.
I seem to be talking a lot. So then I basically, in my first year, Mary Robinson was my tutor.
Yeah.
And in my second year, Mary McAleese is my tutor. And at the end of second year, what happened was I got very involved with what's called the Vincent de Paul. And there was a girl I fancied in the Vincent de Paul who was doing medicine in UCD. And at the end of the, you know, you go off on the summers, you go off traveling around doing interrailing on the trains. And just by coincidence, I ended up in the same place at the end of this where she was. And it was down in the South Italy and this the Sorrento coast. We're staying at this really beautiful place. And there was one particular evening where I was sitting outside the on the edge of the cliff overlooking the Mediterranean. Sun was setting, really romantic. Anyway, shag all happened romantically. But she did say to me she couldn't understand why they didn't let me do medicine and she thought it was ridiculous. So, as I said, I didn't score, but I went straight back, met Mary McAleese, and a week later I was doing medicine. So I actually only met her recently or a few months ago and told her I've been telling this story to other people since. And yeah, so that's how I ended up doing medicine.
Yeah.
Right, go ahead, Terry.
No, I was just going to say, you're doing a lot of walk in the inner city.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
So what happened was, I actually was agnostic since I was around 18, but I joined the Vincent de Paul in Trinity. And when you're doing law, you've only 5 lectures a week, so I had tons of time. So I got involved in the inner, I always say 2 educations. The education inside the walls of Trinity, which is the education from, you know, about medicine.
Academically,
but,
yeah.
Academic. But then the education outside the walls was actually as important in terms of my life.
From the streets then.
From the streets, yeah. So when I was in the Vincent de Paul, like, you know, I got involved because I used to be in the Scouts before and I got involved in youth work. And first of all, I started working with kids from Markovitch House in a youth club up on Herbert Street. And then I got involved doing the summer project in Pierce Street. And that was a baptism of fire. And then I started doing the playground. You remember the old playgrounds that used to be in Church Street and Hill Street? And I was in Ballyfermot most of the time. But I continued working with kids. We started taking kids out on hikes from Pierce Street, Ballyfermot, and also from Joey's Mansions and Sean McDermott Street. And we started the youth club up in Dorset Street. And we started visiting old folks in Joey's Mansions. And also I was working with people with disabilities as well from the Cheshire Homes. So I actually fell in love with the inner city then. I just loved the crack and the banter. And like it was fairly wild those days. And but like we were taking kids on hikes. And like, I mean, I remember one kid looking at a horse and calling it a cow. They didn't know it was that it was a horse. And so we used to get lost up the mountains. There were the days when, you know, nowadays going out with kids, you have to have this, guard a vet and insurance and everything. There were the days, you know, we went off down camping. And we'd bring in the kids and telling ghost stories in the middle of graveyards and, you know, just doing things that were probably a bit crazy, but great crack. And I loved the kids and they had a great vitality about them.
You would have seen a lot of change in the inner city over the years.
What happened is when I came back and basically I worked with them for a number of years and then I ended up going off to medicine. I ended up stopped working in the inner city. I came back in 1997 and I started in a practice in the inner city. It was just myself and one receptionist. And Jesus Christ, it was like getting hit with a truck. I'd never seen, like, as you know, from Dorset Street, like, I'd never seen so many people who'd lost young people to death to drugs. The amount of families who'd lost 2 or 3 kids because of drug addiction. And every month I was going to a funeral of a young person. And if I go back to I used to work in Joey's Mansions with a group of 15 kids. And one day I got called to do a house call in Sean McDermott Street to a guy who was dying of hepatitis C and he had no GP and they couldn't get a GP. So I called down and I arrived and as the door opened, out comes this woman and she says, "Jeez, Austin, how are you?" And it was Margaret, it was one of the kids. So I was saying, "Jeez, good to see you." And we're chatting away and then her sister came out and she was another of the kids. And then we went in, we're chatting away and then I said, "How are all the others?" And then you have the 15, I think it was 6 that died from drug addiction. And there was one of them, there was one kid, I remember he was absolute nightmare and his name was Maggot and I thought, "Oh Christ, he's probably one of the kids that died." So I said, "How's Maggot? Was he one of them?" And they said, "Oh no," and they went out and screamed up, "Maggot, come down here." Anyway, Maggot was upstairs, so he came down and met him as well. But I suppose that just demonstrated how the drug addiction and so it was a devastated community.
And even speaking of Joseph Manson's, you know, there, so at the end of Sean McDermott Street, when you turn left to go up Amien Street then, the Christmas tree that's there every year is a memorial to all the people that have died from drug-related deaths throughout the years. And I remember that growing up, they'd have like all the memorials to them. And I asked me man that, like, what's that all about? And they were like, that's everyone that's doping drugs. But as a child, I'm like, what's drugs? And like, how are they killing so many people? And like, it's like, you know, when you say a memorial to a disaster, you know, that was the bombings. So they had the Alma bombings, and then there was the bombings on Parnell Street then.
Yeah.
And there's a memorial to that on Talbot Street. So I was like, Jesus, that was a big disaster. Look at all the people that have died. You're looking at this Christmas tree. There's more names on that than anything else. And you're like, this is absolutely decimating communities.
I mean, if that had been Black Rock or Fox Rock that had been happening, it would have been a political, you know, crisis. There would have been, it would have changed governments because, you know, that was all young people dying. If young people in Fox Rock were dying like that, it would have been a disaster. But because of the inner city, I didn't even know it was happening. Like, you know, all my friends in the out where I came from didn't know this was happening. It was just, I think it's one of the most horrific stories in the Irish states. The fact that this all young people were allowed to die, and because of which community it was coming from, it didn't hit the news.
Mm, and it's preventable.
It's absolutely, it's prevent. It, well, I suppose what I say preventable, I often think is people often say, you know, anyone can be a drug user, you know. You know, every they say everyone can be a drug user. I think that's crap because I go around to, you know, I'm often giving talks to medical students. And you have a class of 150, and I'll say, many of you know someone who's a drug user. They used heroin or crack cocaine. You might find four or five people put their hands up. And then I say, how many of you know someone who's died of heroin? You might find one. And I say, I can walk into an inner city primary school of 8-year-olds and ask those same two questions, and everybody put their hands up to everyone. Because it's poverty and inequity that causes drug addiction. So when you say it's preventable if we can address the issues of poverty. Now, it'll take a number of generations. That's where it's causing it. And that's what we need to do to address it.
Yeah, definitely. It's like me and Calvin have said on this podcast so many times. It's like when we hear one of our parents telling a story, or someone in our family from an older generation telling a story about growing up and being with their friends, they'll tell a story involving 6 or 7 people, and they'll halfway through the story, they'll be saying, oh, we were with Jonna, he's dead now though. Oh yeah, and Anne, she's dead now. They can't tell a story without having most of their friends passed away from drug use, which is horrific.
I don't know if you know Louise Lowe. She runs this company called The New Productions, a theatre thing, but she comes from the inner city. And she had something, I can't remember the exact numbers, but like it was a class of 14, and I think it was 11 or 12 died. I mean, that's crazy. Younger women.
Yeah, and the only thing is, people don't realise the ripple effect of that. Like, you know, like there's siblings burying siblings, friends burying friends, but then the parents burying children there. Like, you're just supposed to get on with it. Like, that's something that just happened. As you said, like, if it was happening in a different community, a more affluent community, it'd be a national outcry. But like, you're not even thinking of the knock-on effect and the legacy it's having. You know, like, we have people now who are coming into their middle ages and elderly people who have buried numerous kids. I have friends with family members who have buried numerous kids. Crazy, actually, when you think about it. And it's only probably when we get older now and we're at this age where our parents would have been, and they're reflecting back. But we're able to reflect and pinpoint stuff and point out, like, what needs to happen or what should have happened there. But back then, I think our parents would just be like, this is life, we get on with it. But the baggage they have to carry with them now as well, it's crazy. Like,
yeah, and having to deal with all that grief, I agree with you. And I think the only reason that, you know, why was there not a white outcry, it's because ultimately we all blame drug users for being for the drug problem. So, you know, we still have this idea that being a drug user,
it's self-inflicted.
And I remember Irving Welsh, you know, the guy who wrote Trainspotting?
Yeah.
He was doing an interview on the radio, and it was really interesting because he used to be on heroin. And the person said, well, how do you get off heroin? He said, oh, it was easy. And she said, it's easy. He said, yeah, it was easy for me because I was only using heroin for the crack, he says. But he says, a lot of people who are on heroin are using it because they're using it to heal the trauma they had as children. He says, they don't get off it easy. They end up finding it really difficult to get off. So I see heroin use and drug use as, you know, the effects of childhood trauma, which are huge. A lot of people have had a huge impact from the trauma as children. They're carrying all this rage and anger. And the only way to let it die down is they're using drugs to heal it. Same way as, you know, it's not legal drugs they're using to heal it. It's illegal drugs. And that's why they find it so hard to give up. Because actually, physically, it's easy enough to give up heroin. But if you're using it to heal that, you can't.
So circumstances are leading them to go on it. And then even trying to come off it, there's a lack of services as well, especially for them.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, you're on it, you're stuck, you want to go off it, but there's nothing in place for you to go off it. So
yeah, we need a rapid expansion of of stabilization and detox facilities. They're, I mean, they're oversubscribed at the moment. Yeah.
Did I see somewhere if you have 5 traumatic events in your childhood, it decreases your life expectancy by 20 years?
Yeah. They did this research over in the US where they identified 10 different traumatic events. So one is if you're a victim of physical or abuse or neglect. That's 2. Then another 2 was emotional abuse or neglect. And the last one was sexual abuse. But then if you had a parent who died young, a parent who was a drug or alcohol user, a parent with a mental health problem, and parents who divorced, and I think there was one more, I can't remember it, but there was altogether 10. And they basically measured how many people had these. Now, a lot of people had 1 or 2. But once you went over 4, your rates of almost everything increased. Now, when you went over 5, your life expectancy reduced by 20 years. If you're over 4, your chances of having ischemic heart disease, lung disease, any disease you can think of increased hugely. And it wasn't just diseases that were related to smoking or alcohol. It was any disease. Your chance of being a smoker was around 10 or 15 times higher. Your chance of being an alcohol or drug user, your chance of being a perpetrator of violence, or a chance of being a victim of violence. Almost anything you can think of just shot up. And so it was then, ultimately, we all know if you had a messed up childhood, you can have a messed up adulthood. But they started putting the science and the figures on it. And it's just horrific the impact that childhood adversity has on future. And, you know, we all claim we love our children and we treasure our children. But when we're creating the circumstances that cause our children to be exposed to that. So, like, for example, when we create homelessness, we're causing childhood trauma. And then we're going to have to pay to deal with the impact of that later on in life. Yeah. So that's, yeah. So 20 years is huge, isn't it?
Yeah, when you look at a quarter of a life.
Yeah.
When you think about it.
Yeah. And there's these great things they do over in the UK, and you could do it in Ireland, it hasn't been done, but they actually follow the tube station. And they actually show, because it isn't just child adversity causes you to have a lower life expectancy. If you're born in an area of deprivation, say like inner city Dublin, your life expectancy is immediately minimum of 6 years less. Not only is your life expectancy less, but you're, of that shorter life, you will spend twice as long with chronic disease. And they do these great maps following the tube station in the UK, where as you go from tube station to tube station, you can see the life expectancy. And as you're going into the less well-off areas, you just see it shoot down. It's a really fascinating map.
Jesus yeah. Christ.
Yeah.
I obviously understand how life expectancy can drop with circumstances and stuff like that. But when you hear 20 blading years, it's a bit what the
fuck? You're even just being born in a certain area code, you're getting dropped by 6 years.
Yeah.
Even that's mad.
It's mad. And I think the people always, when people hear this, a lot of people say, oh, that's because they smoke too much or they drink too much.
Yeah.
And smoking rates are higher, but smoking and drinking too much only accounts for around 1/5 of that excess mortality. 4/5 is just due to the stress of dealing with poverty. And even if you take the smokers, 95% of people who are homeless smoke. Why the fuck wouldn't you smoke if you were homeless?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. So if you're going to put people in poor circumstances, of course you're going to get more of them smoking, because smoking is a way of dealing with stress.
It's an escape.
Yeah. So, you can't blame them for smoking more because you've created the circumstances. They often show, for example, that for single mothers, a smoke is actually a way of getting a break, because you go out the door because you don't have your child smoking, but you get away from the child for a few minutes to have a smoke, which just gives you that little break to cope. And, it's tough enough being a parent when you've got the 2 parents, so imagine being a parent. Of course you need a break.
Mm. What are some issues that you'd see as a GP after being working in the inner city that you wouldn't maybe see in more affluent areas?
Well, first of all, drug addiction is much higher. So you'll see a lot of that. You'll also see a lot of homelessness. So again, people often think homelessness is a life choice or a thing. Vast majority of people who are homeless come from areas of deprivation. So I'm often in my own practice, and next thing I have a patient, they disappear. And then I go into the homeless practice and they're there. And I say, what happened to you? And I said, oh, I was caught by the mad doing this, and they had a big row, and then I've gone off. And then 6 months later, you go, when they're gone from the homeless practice, you go home, we're back together again. And so, it does come from poverty, the vast majority of homeless, not all of it. So anyway, that's the second thing you see a lot of. You're also Jesus Christ, the complexity of general practice in the inner city. So you go in and you meet someone who's got lung disease, but they're a much younger age. They're in their 40s, whereas, you go out to an affluent area, they're in their 50s or 60s. You're trying to deal with them to help with their lung disease. they miss doctor's appointments because there's problems with one of their kids and they have to get there trying to sort their kid out and they miss an appointment. They're smoking. You're trying to get them off smoking and they really try to get off smoking and they get off the smoking. But then, you know, something happens at home and there's a big blow up and they end up back smoking again, or one of the kids gets into trouble and they end up back smoking. And then you're trying, and then they feel bad because they feel it's their own fault for smoking. Mm. And then they're dealing with the stress of the kids as well. So you're also managing that. So, you know, if you're working in a more affluent area, you tend to have just one or two problems. Whereas they say what really defines working inner city Dublin and our areas of deprivation is just the complexity of the issues and the amount of problems that are coming into one consultation. Mm. And then, I mean, the other thing, like I always say, is like you're working with kids who, I always give this story. I had one young kid. She was an incredibly bright kid. She was looking after a mother who had addiction problems. She was looking after a brother who had psychological problems. She was only 12 and she was doing all the shopping and cooking and minding of those kids. And then she came into the junior cert and she came in and her ma came in with her ma was really proud of her because she just got 12 honours. Now, Jesus, 12 honours. This is an incredibly bright kid. So I said, that's brilliant. Because I thought, now you can go on to leave and cert and go to uni then. So I said, what are you going to do when you... What do you want to do in college? Will you go to college? She said, what do you mean to go to college? She said, I'm leaving next week. And I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm becoming a hairdresser. And I just thought, this is ridiculous because where I come from, you know, I didn't even hope to go to college. I just presumed I was going to college. Mm. And so I really worked with her. I got her to see a counselor. I got her to see a school leaving officer, but she still left, became a hairdresser. And so you see that lack of just expectation or hope. And I just think that's so sad.
It's actually mad because the college I went to, NCI, in the financial centre, and that was my first choice college. It was my first choice course and I was happy to be there. And I was in college with people and this was the second or third or in some cases fourth choice. And I was like, oh, I'm happy to be here. You're disappointed that, like, there's some people that are disappointed that they're
there. That's, yeah.
And I'm like, this is mad. Like, I mean, that's just all fucking happy to be in college together, you know? But again, that's what that is. It's our expectancy. Like, some people would be expected to get 500 plus points in their leaving cert. And I know that that's a disappointment. Whereas where I'm from, if you do your leaving cert, you're a success. No matter what you get, you set the thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, and then you see people like Lynn Rouen, who only went back to college, you know, years after, you know, when everyone else was gone, and you see what she's able to do when she gets it. So not only is it it's a shame for the people from the inner city, but it's also a huge loss to us as a society.
Yeah.
Because there's an incredible amount of smart and talented people there who were just wasting. And I think it's the saddest thing I've seen is that loss of... see a young person just lose their life like that.
Maybe. Yeah, it's one of the most disappointing things in humanity is a waste of talent. And that's what we're doing. We're letting talent just go by the wayside. And in everything, whether it be arts, business, sports, everything, there's just talent there dripping through the wayside. Like, you would know it, and obviously you would know from walking there, Austin.
Yeah.
How many characters do you know from town? Yeah. How many, like, comedians do you know? Singers?
Yeah.
How creative people are? How athletic people are and how driven and determined that if they put their mind to starting a business, it's going to be a fucking successful business. If they put their mind to a sport, they're going to be good at the sport. Or if they have to tell you a story, they're going to have you gripped from the second they start speaking. Imagine you just nurture that, what you'd get. And we're starting to see some of it drip through now. And I think we're starting to see a lot more than we used to.
Absolutely.
We're not seeing enough.
No, absolutely. No, I agree. I mean, even the spoken word poetry, that's really, that comes from inner city Dublin, or Finglas Lewis is in the inner city. I don't know if you know him. He was a great spoken word poet with Bowes. And so I think I agree with you that there's a huge amount of talent. Yeah. And it is starting to come through. But still, there's a lot, you know, we need to build on that.
Yeah, in terms of percentages, the percentage coming through is increasing, but we're still letting a vast majority go to waste.
So one of the smartest guys I think I ever knew was a guy who used drugs, and I used to always say to him, I said, you know, you could be, you're a super genius, you could do anything you wanted in college. And he sort of knew it, but he couldn't get away from the drugs. And I actually almost felt sorry for him because he sort of knew, he was smart enough to know that he was wasted.
Mm.
And yet he just couldn't get away from it. Yeah, it was horrific. It was
You touched on earlier that you've done a lot of work with homelessness and GPs. You've set up a service for homeless people with GP reception, have you?
I set up a number of things. So I set up Safety Net, which is a service that provides, it does GP inreach to hostels with GPs and nurses for homeless people. It does drop-in centres for homeless people. It provides drop-in centres for migrants and for Roma, a number of them, and for undocumented migrants. It does a mobile health unit for migrants. It does screening for migrants and homeless people and prisoners. I also set up GMQ, which is in the Granby, which is a... We have around 120 people every morning. We have four doctors and we provide GP services and a lot of addiction treatment as well for homeless people and migrants as well. And then I also set up the first GP training programme in the world to train GPs to work in areas of deprivation. And we set up in 2009. And it specifically trains GPs to work in areas of deprivation and with marginalised groups such as homeless, drug users. So as part of their training, they work in services. They work in areas of deprivation with GPs in areas of deprivation, but they also work in service for homeless, for drug users, for migrants. And in fact, we've been copied now, and there's similar services in Scotland, the UK, and I think there's altogether there's around 1,800 GP trainees now across England and Ireland and Scotland in similar training programmes. And I've also founded a service called GP Care for All that develops GP practice in area deprivation. So, you know, Summerhill Health Centre?
Yeah.
We set up a practice in the Summerhill Health Centre and we're, to give you an example, you know Finglas, you know, you go up the road in Finglas and there's the West Finglas on one side and East Finglas on the other.
Yeah.
East Finglas and West Finglas have around the same amount of people, 27,000 people. I think there's 11 GP practices in East Finglas and there's none in West Finglas. You know, West Finglas is the area that has the higher health. We call it the Tudor Heart Inverse Care Law. People most need the health services or most need service are least likely to get them. And obviously they're much sicker in West Finglas, but they don't have, so we're starting a GP practice there in the next year or so. So that's, they're the things.
Did I read something that like 45% of homeless people don't have a medical card?
What happened was we did research back in 2005 and we found that even though 100% of homeless people, you know, and like I told you, the health indices and life expectancy for people in deprivation, when you get to homelessness, it's like going up a cliff. Yeah. Everything, it's much worse. So they're the most in need of healthcare. And yeah, when we first did the research in 2005, 45% of homeless people. But what I always say to you, if you want a homeless person not to use your service, get them to fill a form in. Because, you know, homeless people, a lot of them have illiteracy issues. And also they don't like filling in forms. I hate filling in forms. And then if you really don't want them to use your service, get to make that form as complex as possible. And I don't know if you've seen the medical card application. It's a really complex form. So it's no surprise.
Yeah.
There's so few people. They should just automatically get one from once they, you know, they shouldn't have to fill a form and it should just be assigned to them.
It's a really high percentage of people to not have one.
It's a really high percentage. Now, we did it again around 5 years ago and 25% didn't have a medical card. But even of the ones who did have a medical card, a lot of them didn't use it because the medical card was out in Tala or even down the country. So it was too far for them to go. So that's why we ended up setting the services up that we did, yeah.
And a lot of it is fixed around having an address though, isn't it, really? Like you're sending, like just, you're getting sent letters and stuff to say your appointment's on this date. Where's that going?
Well, hospital appointments, I actually write an article I've been trying to do over the last 6 months called The Four Most Stupid Things in Medicine. And the most stupid thing in medicine is sending hospital appointments to homeless people. You know, they don't have an address. So you send out the appointment, they don't get it. Even if they do get it, their lives are all chaotic. They don't have diaries. They don't have regular lives. They don't have cars to get them the appointment. So even if they do get it, they're unlikely to keep it. And we've been, like, I every morning in my clinic, I open at least 12 letters saying, did not attend. So just to give an example of how you can shift that around, in our Granby, we had 40 people. When they have these new treatments for hepatitis C. You know, hepatitis C is an infection of the liver that you can get from injecting drugs and it can kill you. Like I have a lot of people who died from it. And they developed these new treatments a number of years back that cure it, 99% cure rates. And I sent 40 people who had hepatitis C for their appointment for this new life-saving treatment. And 23 missed the first appointment, 6 missed the second, and only 2 completed treatment. So what we did is we got a peer worker, someone who was previously a drug user and a homeless person, Bernard, he's fantastic. He came and worked with us and we got the doctors from the clinic to come to us. And between Bernard and the doctors coming to us, we got all 40 treated and we've had all over 100 treated since. So, you know, there is a solution. Develop a service that suits the needs of homeless people rather than, I think what happens is the people, when we did our duty, we sent out the appointment, even though they know it isn't going to work.
Mm.
So they need to start thinking outside the box and developing a health service that's of use to homeless people, not one, because really we've developed a service for middle class people because they do keep appointments.
Yeah, so we need to be more robust. Because
yeah.
I was reading you saying stuff about that before, but then I was thinking as well, like in America, homeless people have jobs, you know, and
yeah.
It's crazy that like how people employ homeless people. They know this person has no fixed address. They have no real stability outside of this 9-to-5 job, but they will employ them.
Yeah. And I mean, unemployment's a great way of getting out of homelessness. America's slightly different because in America, you know, homelessness is much bigger. You know, yeah. we often get upset, and we should get upset about people being homeless. But like, I went to LA and there's 60,000 people on the street in LA. Like, it's madness. And you go everywhere and you see tons of people.
Mm.
So over there, it's almost like it's part of the economy. So, you know, a lot of low paid workers.
Yeah.
So it is slightly different. But I do think, you know, part of recovery is getting a job and getting things. And I think we do discriminate against homeless people, you know, and people who've got clean of drugs and are on recovery. So they find it very hard to get jobs because of the discrimination. I think even people in inner city with Dublin accents, you know, you probably have, I've heard of people changing their accent.
Definitely.
Or if they all say, if you have a Dublin accent, you won't get a job.
These are stories that we've
listeners have lives. Listeners are probably listening saying, don't tell that story again.
Okay.
We've loads of stories about that.
I can well imagine, yeah.
Discrimination and perception in general. So, Austin, if you want to just take us back a little bit, you mentioned thalidomide earlier on.
Yeah.
I have an idea of what that is or was, but there's many people that wouldn't understand. Okay. So do you want to give us an explanation into what that was?
Okay, there was a big scandal back in the early 60s. So what happened was there was this medication called thalidomide, and it was marketed as helping women with morning sickness. And it was also marketed as a way of helping sleep for women. And in those days, when they produced drugs, they didn't test them in pregnant women. So they were marketing it. And next thing, all these babies were being born with shortened limbs. And like, it was remarkable. It all depended on when you took it. It didn't matter. In fact, like, you could take one tablet. So I know a friend of mine who took one tablet. Her mother took one tablet. And she basically has no legs and no arms. So the level of disability didn't matter. It wasn't worse with more tablets. It was when you took it. Because it was when you were having your limbs formed in the first 6 weeks of pregnancy. And not only did it cause you to lose limbs, but there was a lot of people that had miscarriages. And when this came out originally, it caused a huge scandal. And in fact, you know the way all drugs are tested and everything, and drugs are really warned against pregnancy? That's all because of thalidomide. All those warnings came and all those regulations were brought in because of thalidomide. So as we say with people with thalidomide, you know, everyone else was made safer for everyone else after us because of what happened to us. So there was a lot of people in the world had this happen to. In Ireland, there was around 40 people. There's ongoing cases about this, legal cases about compensation, etc., and about a recognition. Because, I mean, at the time when Ireland had thalidomide, when this came to announce, it was announced that it was a thing internationally. Everyone just made announcements on the news and told everyone to get rid of any medication. In Ireland, they took it away from pharmacy silently, but didn't make a national announcement. And what happened was, people in Ireland, their mothers had thalidomide that they'd left over, and they took it, and next thing, pregnancies happened after, or there was doctors who had free samples. And the reason they didn't make a big public announcement was, in Ireland, you remember, the Catholic Church was very much in power, and they believed that if they made a big announcement about this, that mothers who were pregnant would go off and have terminations in England.
Mm.
So because they were fearful, you know, in our Catholic ethos, they'd go off terminations, they didn't make the announcement. Subsequently, further children got affected. So
it's crazy, isn't it? Like,
it was crazy.
When you actually think about it, like, hiding the information.
I mean,
you know, and everyone else is around the world is announcing, and you're like, keep that quiet.
Keep that quiet, yeah. And it was, and you know, and the reason was because the Catholic Ireland at the time. And so, anyway, so that's what happened. So that's how, does that sort of make you understand? Yeah,
perfect. Yeah. But actually worse than what I thought it was.
Oh, no, it was horrific. You saw back in the 60s, like, there was all these pictures of all these kids with these disabilities. And like, when you see, I've got friends who have no limbs, or very small stubs of limbs, people in wheelchairs. So like, I'm not mildly affected, but Jesus, much worse people going around than me and with it. So it was just horrific.
It's scary, that, yeah. And there was something else that you mentioned earlier as well. You were saying about, you were told that you wouldn't be able to work as a doctor in the hospitals because of all the walking and stuff like that. So is that why you ended up going in to be a GP then?
Well, I always wanted to be a GP, you know, because I mean, I was working in the community. So remember I told you I was working in the inner city and I worked around the community. So I loved work. So I never wanted to be anything but a GP.
Right.
But you have to train in a hospital. Now, interestingly, what happened was they said I wouldn't be able to take bloods as well, you know. And interestingly, when I went to take bloods, I did find it difficult because I can't use my thumb. But now, you know, I work a lot with people who use drugs. And if they need bloods taken, I'm the best. And you know, it's really hard to get people because they obviously inject drugs into their veins.
Yeah, the veins.
And so when they find it difficult, I'm one of the best at getting the bloods out. So ironic. In fact, it was just lack of imaginative thinking on behalf of the doctors. And I could do it, yeah. But I did find it hard walking around because I can't walk very far. But I got through it.
It's funny, like it's, you're standing up at people who are being discriminated against, come from an area that discriminated against, and you're somebody in turn who's being discriminated against in that profession as well. It's crazy when you think about it that way.
Well, it's interesting because what happened was, you know, I remember I told you I worked for the Vincent DePaul, and the Vincent DePaul is sort of like a charity ethos, you know, let's help those people who are less well off. And, you know, I have great respect for people involved in charities. I work with a lot of charities. I think they do brilliant work. But in the 90s, I got involved with the Disability Rights Organization. And that was a real approach of, you know, it's about rights. It's not about charity. And, you know, there's the classic image of the disabled person sitting there looking, collecting money. I had a friend who was queuing up in Atlantic Home Care after buying a bucket, and she was in a wheelchair. And as she was queuing up to pay for the bucket, someone put money in the bucket. That's because, you know, people see disabled people and they feel sorry for them. That's because the charity ethos. Whereas it isn't about feeling sorry for people, it's about giving people their rights. So now when I'm in the inner city, it's not about feeling sorry for people in the inner city. It's about, we've really screwed over people in the inner city because of our economic policies and the way we've created this poverty. So it's their rights to get these things. So, you know, I teach trainees, you know, it's not about being a good doctor because you feel sorry for people. You need to feel for people to help them. But the really reason you're doing this is because it's their right and we haven't enforced their rights. So that changed my whole approach. So disability actually, you know, I'm not saying I want to be disabled, no way, but it gave me a lot of things as well.
As you probably nearly just answered the question that I had next. Was like, I know you explained about coming into the inner city many years ago and all the things you've done since then, but I was going to say, like, you could have easily got a job in a more affluent area and you didn't. You chose to walk in the inner city.
You know, like when I started the inner city, I did the summer project in Pear Street. That was wild. So, for example, I remember we, as part of it, we did a, you know, we used to do rag week in college. So I decided to do a rag week as a summer project. And I remember going around and we said we'd do a water day as they do in rag week. And I remember meeting all these kids in Pear Street. And next thing, they're off chasing these Spanish students. So I'm chasing off trying to get them. And then I eventually all get them. We decided we'd go around to each of the flat complexes. And I think we're going to go in and meet a few parents and, you know, a few kids. And I walk into Pear Street, which is 5,000 people living in it. All along the balconies are mothers with buckets and binfuls of water. And actually, water's going everywhere. And then I go up to Leo Fitzgerald, the same happens. So it's wild. And then we go on a ghost hunt with these kids and we're joined by these skinheads who start chasing the ghosts I've placed en route. And, you know, it was just wild. I mean, I'm just half the stories and that. So I had, you know, the things that happen when you're working there, just wild. It was great crack.
Yeah.
And I just loved it.
Just lured you in.
Oh, yeah. No, Jesus, they wrecked my head as well on occasions, but I just loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. What was this tree fuck syndrome?
Oh, the triple fuck syndrome.
Yeah.
I wrote an article for a medical magazine. I'm very proud of this because it's the only medical article I know of that is the word fuck in the title.
Yeah.
What I think it is that, you know, the three fucks are, the first fuck is we create a society that allows people to be born into poverty. So I think we fuck people over for being born into poverty. You know, that's what society has done. But the second fuck is even worse. We don't just put them into poverty. We blame them for being in poverty. So, you know, basically we blame the poor for being poor. So you hear, you know, the former Taoiseach saying that he represents the party that gets up early in the morning.
Yeah, and Tony Tim should have got out and got a job.
Yeah, implying that people in areas of deprivation don't get up or unemployed people don't get up. I remember I was saying he's never been in a hostel, they're up at 6:30 in the morning. And then, you know, you see all these stories about scroungers. And he even, the Fine Gael were doing this campaign against welfare cheaters cheat us all. He didn't say tax cheaters cheat us all. You know, that's because his party is the taxpayers. And, you know, taxpayers cheat us of much more money than welfare benefits do. And he didn't put one out saying those banks who screwed us over in the economic recession, you know, cheat us all. And, you know, the amount of money that was lost on that. So it's all about the welfare benefits. That's because they're blaming the poor. And then not only do they blame the poor for being poor, but they also blamed it for the behaviours caused by poverty. So, you know, as I said, I was telling you earlier on, addiction is comes from poverty and homelessness. And we blame people for being addicts. We blame people for being homeless. Less so for being homeless, actually, more so for addiction. And so that's the second fuck. We blame them for being poor and for the effects of poverty. The third fuck was what I call the medical fuck, because I don't know if you've ever heard the term personality disorder.
Yeah.
And lots of people in inner city Dublin get diagnosed as being personality disorder. What personality disorder is where, you know, you behave with challenging behaviours. You basically, you know, you're difficult to manage. And it's a real behavioural thing. And in medicine, like, it's well known, we tend to label people with the term personality disorder who we don't like. And that and it's a real trash can of a diagnosis. Now, the people who have been diagnosed with it have great time for us. I'm not saying they're in the trash can. I'm saying the diagnosis itself, the label. And the thing is, there's actually all this evidence to show that there's very little you can do for a person with personality disorder. And there's also this evidence show that if you get the disorder, you're hugely stigmatized by medics. They refuse to take you on in their practice. They will say, oh, we don't serve people with personality disorder. It's a medical diagnosis that actually causes more problems for you than help. So that's why I call it the triple fuck, because also personality disorder applies to people who tend to have, say, challenging behaviors such as drug addiction, such as aggression, and they're associated with poverty. So, you know, people in poverty are much more likely to get this label than people in well-off areas. So that's why it's called the triple fuck.
It's brilliant, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely brilliant. I was reading it earlier on and I was like, fucking hell, this class. And then obviously the title.
I know, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also say it's interesting because, you know, everyone says, oh, fuck's a bad language. And I say, you know, language, it's, you know, what is bad language? So I say, where I'm working in the inner city of Dublin, like, everyone uses the word fuck all the time. Every single consultation, you know, fuck this and I thing and bollocks. And, you know, I say is those clients I have are homeless. They're using this language and all the people in Fox Rock and Black Rock are calling it, where I come from, calling it that bad language. But if they go into hospital and someone says, you know, this is disgraceful the way you've been behaving, you're a disgrace, how dare you do this? That's bad language to them. So, you know, it's just because one group happened to be in power, they define this as bad language. Whereas, you know, the bad language for people in homeless is, you know, how dare you behave that way and pull yourself together and don't treat, you know, so language is defined by who's in power.
Mm. Brilliant.
You're a big advocate for exercise.
Oh, yeah. No, exercise. I mean, what I say is 15 years ago, I actually was preparing to be in a wheelchair. I could only walk 50 yards. And when I walked 50 yards, I'd have to stop at least once or twice over those 50 yards. So what I decided to do was I actually started making preparations in the house that I'd have a wheelchair. But then I decided I'll try and keep it going as long as possible. So I lost weight. I lost 20 kgs of weight. And
20 kilo?
20 kilos, yeah.
Fucking hell, that's that.
And I did it. And then I got really fit. Now, I was fit before I used to do cycling, but I got really fit. And I got fit through cycling. I do a lot of cycling. But also, as part of my fitness, I wanted to stop getting osteoporosis, you know, this bone thin in the bones. And you can get osteoporosis if you don't walk a lot and if you don't impact.
Yeah.
So I went to talk to someone and there was this doctor actually. And she said, if you want to not get exercise, dance. Because dance, you know, bang, bang, bang. So now I do like dancing. So it was interesting. Like, I mean, I couldn't walk 50 yards with pain, but I could get up and dance for a night. Now, I'd be wrecked after it, but because your head is engaged in the music, you don't feel the pain. So what I started doing was what I called silent disco. So I'd go down to the garage, wear some earphones. I'd have just me cycle tights on. I'd tell my kids, don't bring any friends because they'd be mortified. If they see me. And I'd do silent discos. And then I suddenly found I could walk further. And eventually I found myself walking longer and eventually I could walk up to 3K. So exercise has transformed my life. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I'm telling people, you know, they're coming in. We tell older people, oh, take it easy.
Yeah.
I'm telling older people, exercise more. The older you get, the more you have to do.
In the fucking time, like in my family, I'm telling my aunties, and I don't care how old you are, you're 70, 80, like, go out and do your walk. If you need to stop and take a breath and relax for a minute, do that. but then get more steps.
Yeah,
there's all this. I hate that term as well of like slow down, kick the feet up now.
Yeah,
no, fuck that.
Do more because if you want to, if you want to use it, you want to keep it. GPS doing it.
It's use it or lose it, isn't it?
Use it or lose it. That's it. Yeah, use it or lose it. And like I remember, my mother was in her 90s and like she was very immobile, but we still got her on an exercise bike because we keep whatever you can. Doesn't matter what exercise you do, keep it because once you stop for rounds. 3 days, you start getting muscle wasting.
Yeah.
And so you can imagine someone who's in their 70s, that muscle wasting, you know, they need their muscles. And then what happens? They get sick. So they go to bed. And then what happens is when they're bed, they're feeling weak. So everyone says, I'll take it easy. Their muscles are wasting down and you can see it. And then they should be telling them, go on, build up your muscle again. Back up and build. Yeah.
And the biggest prevention of disease at that age is muscle mass.
Muscle mass, absolutely, yeah. Frailty is now an actual medical diagnosis. Mm. And we know that people who are frail die younger.
Yeah.
So you have to, and they're really encouraging older people to get into exercise now and keep, and also eat loads of protein.
Yeah.
Keep your muscle mass up.
Yeah, and this has come from somebody who was told, look, you're going to be in a wheelchair now. And as you said, you're making the adjustments to your house. And you were like, well, look, I'm at the find this other solution. So
yeah,
that's brilliant to see because there could be someone out there that's listening to this that's disabled or has been told by a professional, look, this is how it's going to be. When you're showing people, look, now we can break down this barrier here and there's an alternative.
And it doesn't matter, even if you have a disability, if you're in a wheelchair, you can go out and do wheelchair, you know, racing.
Yeah.
You can do the hand bikes. I was just this weekend as part of a team of people with disabilities doing a 24-hour cycle and two of the people on the team with me were using those hands and they were going faster than me.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were, geez, you can fly along in them.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter if you have a disability, you know, I as a person with disability, I'm able to say I don't give a damn. You still can do bloody exercise. No matter what way you are, you can do some exercise.
So imagine someone that's listening to this, that's an able-bodied person, and they're like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah. They don't get after, for fuck's sake. Me. Tell us about that cycle the weekend. You were telling
it's brilliant, crack. So the basically, Cycling Ireland have this paracycling group, and what to do is, I got asked a year ago, they were trying to get a group together to do this 24-hour cycle. And so we had one team last year, and this year we had two teams. We had one team, which was a group of people with disabilities, five of us on the team, and and then there was a group of paracyclists with visual difficulty or blindness. So they're on the tandems, you know, where the front person is a volunteer and the person on the back, they call them the stoker because they're stoking the engines. So they're the blind person. And they were cycling another team. And so basically you go out over 24 hours and you cycle as many laps in Mondello Race Park. And so you go out and you do half an hour and then you come in for an hour and a half and then you do another half. And you're going hell for leather when you're out there.
Mm.
So altogether, I did 135K over the 24 hours. And you're cycling in the middle of the night. And it's just great crack going around those corners because, you know, they're really cool gliding around. You feel like a real racer. And there's loads of people going past you. So even though they're all sort of racing, they're also, it's not really about racing, you know, or winning. It's about just the event. So everything, oh, fair play to you. And there's a bit of banter going around. So it's great crack. And then you come into the pit lane and you go up to your team and you scream up and halt to halt and you hand over your thing. So it's great excitement and brilliant event. So it's great fun. And we're hoping to get 3 teams in next year.
Class.
That's unreal. That we need to do something like that.
Yeah.
Anyone could, by the way, it's not just, I'm saying it's everyone could put a team in. There was a women's team. If you're into cycling.
That's all for charity, isn't it?
No, it's not for charity. You just go and do it. You just do a team. You could do it for charity if you wanted to, but it's not. It's just you could do it. And if you had a group of other, you can do a team, you can do a solo ride. Like some people did the whole thing. The winner,
on their own.
The winner did, I think, 220 laps. Now, 220 laps is 3.5K, so that's almost over 700K in 24 hours. You can do a 4-person team or an 8-person team.
Fuck that.
Oh, yeah. Hell, over 700K on a bike.
You said you wanted to push yourself in exercise. This will be
keep it. I'll kick the feet up and the legs off. Yeah. Fuck that, man.
Austin, you're one of the first to run the detox centre. From benzos and methadone treatment.
Yeah, we started doing benzo detox. A friend of mine, Fiona Riley, did this research where she found that a lot of people couldn't get off benzos and there was more and more benzos on the street. And so then after that, Carolyn Gardner and Aoife Dermody got together and they set up this community detox program. And then we got a group together which was represented by the HSC, ICGP, Des Crowley was on it. You were asking about it. There was a good few of us. We devised this protocol for community detox. So any GP can do it, but unfortunately not many people are doing it. So we started doing it in the inner city. And what we found is, like, you know, on the streets now, the drug addiction is changing. Like, heroin is less off common now. It's more crack cocaine and tablets. But people are taking massive amounts of tablets. You probably know this, but just...
Yeah.
They're taking up to... Like, the normal is 3 trays of Tranex, and it can be up to 5 or 6 trays of Tranex. Now, a Tranex, to give you an equivalent, Tranex is equal to, you know, a normal Valium tablet is 5 milligram, and a Tranex is equal to around 2 Valium. So you're taking up to 120 Valium a day. So, like, that's phenomenal. Like, that would kill you and me or anyone else. So they're taking these massive doses, and there's nothing to help them. So we do these community detoxes where they come in, they work with a key worker who helps them do drug prevention, them does these drug diaries with them. Then they come into us and we see them every 2 weeks and we gradually bring them down, but they see the key worker as well. So it's not just about seeing a doctor, it's about doing work. You have to do drug relapse prevention as well. And at the moment, we're the first place in the world to do this. So we're actually doing a research on it. And the initial findings are that it works very well. Works particularly well for people who have housing. Less, you know, it tends to be successful for homeless people, but they relapse quickly.
Yeah.
And no surprise. But what it tends to do, even if it doesn't get you, even if you do relapse, they find that your usage is much reduced. So it's been really successful. The other thing we do is we do with the McVerry Trust, and HSE is running a stabilization centre where you can go in and do a 5-week detox of cocaine or benzos. And so there's two of them up on the north side. And that also is very useful. You know, there's detox centres. Detox centres, if you go to a detox centre and you're on, say, tablets or methadone, you have to come off everything. Stabilisation programme is where if you go in and you may be taking street tablets, but you're also on methadone and you're also taking a few prescribed tablets, you can come off the street tablets and stay on the prescribed tablets and your methadone and come out. So
yeah. Well, I don't understand. There's treatment centres out there that to get into the treatment centre, you need to give a clean urine for like 2 weeks prior to it. There's treatment centres out there.
I know.
I'm like, I'm going into the treatment centre to get off.
Okay? I know, yeah.
It just doesn't make sense to me them ones.
Well, what I think is there's been a mix. The treatment centres, there's some of them are a little bit, you know, this idea that, you know, you're good if you're off drugs and you're bad if you're on methadone and stable thing. Whereas to me, is I don't care. Whatever you need to get your life together, it doesn't matter if you need to be on methadone. If you want to get off methadone, great, we'll support you. But if you need to be on methadone to get a job, to get a life, to get a partner, to get kids, that's fine by me. So there's a little bit of that holier-than-thou thing with some of them. But most of them now, actually, they're not like that. They'll work within the harm reduction. But what it was always... was a good few of these. Now there's still a shortage of them, but you had no stabilization centers. So people who wanted to stay on their methadone and stay on the prescribed tablets, but were still using street tablets or street cocaine, had nowhere to go. So now we have them, but we need more of them, a lot more.
So are you in favor of methadone treatment? You know Brian Penny is?
Brian Penny?
Yeah, you're aware of Brian Penny?
No.
How would you describe? He's a former heroin addict. He is a neuroscientist.
Yeah.
He graduated from Trinity, but he was saying on methadone, you don't live on methadone, you just exist on methadone. It's something that they give you just so they can kind of get you to cope.
Okay, well, I'm partly in agreement, but mostly not. Okay, so I'll tell you what my take on methadone is. Everyone gets into their twist over addiction, you know.
Yeah.
It's not addiction's the problem, it's the effects of addiction. Okay, so I'm addicted to exercise, happens to be healthy. If I don't get my exercise, I actually get a bit tetchy and I have to get out. So I really force myself to get out. So there's no problems with the addiction to exercise. Addiction to heroin, if you get addicted to heroin, you can die from overdose. You can get HIV, you can get hepatitis. You lose your job, you end up unemployed, you lose your education, you lose your family, you end up homeless, you end up on the streets. And you can also end up losing weight and getting all these infections all over your body from injecting. Methadone and heroin are more or less the same drug, except there's one that you have to inject and the other you can drink, and one's legal. So, yeah, you're addicted to methadone, but you don't die of overdose. You don't get HIV. You don't get hepatitis. You can keep your family. You can keep your job. You can go to employment. You can go to education. So you can pull your life together. So when it comes to heroin addiction and methadone, much better to be addicted to methadone. Okay. Now, when you're on methadone, if someone's on methadone and they feel I can come off methadone and I'll stay free of heroin, I'd say, great, do that and we'll support you. But if someone's on methadone, and it happens, like a lot of people give up methadone, relapse onto heroin. And if someone is saying, if I come off methadone, I'm going to relapse, then I'd say, that's fine. stay on it, and you can still hold your life. I've seen lots of people on methadone for years who are holding good lives together, and fair play to them. If they want to come off it, fantastic, I'll support you. But I think we get very judgmental. And I think there's one side of judgmental about addiction, saying, oh, addiction's wrong. It's not. It's the harms of addiction. And there is a bit of judgmentalness about, oh, those people stay on methadone, or they call them liquid handcuffs. You know, for some people, it's a liquid handcuff and they want to get off, and let's support them. But if someone wants to stay on it and it keeps their lives together, there's loads of people on different types of drugs, you know, heart drugs, whatever it is, drugs, psychiatric drugs, and they help keep them their lives together. If they need methadone, that's fine. I do agree, though, we need to give more routes for people who do want to get off methadone. I think there isn't enough support for
that. It's not like not enough exits off the road there. Yeah.
So I do agree with that. So, yeah, that's my take on it.
Yeah. And then following on from that, you're also a big voice of decriminalisation then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it goes back to the whole issue of, do you blame people for being using drugs or not? And I mean, decriminalisation, where you're actually putting the person who's using the drugs into prison. It's, I mean, first of all, I think it's morally wrong. You know, you should be helping them, not criminalise them, because you've created the problems that caused it in the first place. Society creates poverty, which caused the addiction. So morally, I think it's wrong. But also, pragmatically, it's so ridiculously ineffective. Like in Portugal, they found, once they introduced decrim, problem drug use is where you inject heroin, that reduced. Death rates from HIV and from overdose plummeted.
Mm.
I mean, the amount of people with HIV just plummeted in Portugal after they introduced
decriminalization.
And same with the amount of people who've overdosed, improved dramatically. You know, we should be focusing on the people who sell the drugs. That has to be criminalized, because they're selling the drugs, and the dealers, and particularly the people behind that even. And stop wasting our time. It's really about, you know, rather than sending people to prison where you're not doing anything for their, you know, they do get some help, but you should be sending them to health services.
Yeah.
So it's called the health-led approach. So if you find someone who's got drugs on them for their own use, rather than send them to prison, send them to a health practitioner, and they need to engage. And I mean, the way it happens is the decrim or health-led approach is you send them back a number of times, and if they don't engage, then you send them, you know, then they do get into the criminal justice system. So it's not saying that they don't end up there, but you're just saying is give them the health option first.
Yeah, I actually saying Lynn Rowan, she was with the Drugs Council Committee.
DPC, the Drugs Policy Committee, yeah.
Yeah, but there was there from the Department of Health, there was a member there, and she quizzed him on what are the health benefits of criminalising someone who's getting caught with drugs for personal use. And it's great because he's like, he's not able to give a fine bullet point, this is it, this is why we do that. And his response to one of them was that, oh, like, we do offer a detox and a health follow-up, but it's not mandatory. So it's like, well, what's the point? Yeah. You know what I mean? So, and then, like, economically, it does make sense as well. What's the point locking somebody up, giving them a criminal record? It's harder for them to get a job, harder for them to hold down a house then, harder for them to integrate back into society.
Can
the
we
problem
talk about how much it is to keep a prisoner in prison?
This is what I mean. So economically, if you took the money it takes to house a prisoner and put it into the health service for that person to come through the health service, then you take away, or well, you increase the chances of taking away the problem that they had.
Yeah.
Whereas if they're in prison, you give them all these problems as well, and there's a strong chance that they come out of prison with the problem they went in with.
Yeah.
So economically, it just makes sense then to take a new approach.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's been shown that it decreases costs, you know, the health-led benefit. When you take a health-led benefit, it decreases crime in the area. It decreases people falling into homelessness. It's been shown to have multiple benefits to the area and the people in the area. And I know lots of guards who are in support of decrim. They know they're wasting their time putting the people who are using the drugs into prison. They should be focusing on the people who are, you know, dealing and distributing. And they have a sympathy for the people who are using drugs. They want to use a health-led approach.
Hmm.
With the former governor in Mountjoy Prison there as well, he was in the same view as well.
Yeah.
Like, what's the point in having them in there?
No, it's absolutely, yeah. It's very,
but it's almost like it's so easy to see all the benefits, yet there's just nothing happening. It's like that change needs to happen soon.
But also, it goes back to that thing that ultimately a lot of us in society blame drug users.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so that punishment because they blame them. I mean, there's one charity I know in Dublin who mainly works with people who use drugs, and they do a small bit of work with homelessness. They raise all their volunteers, you know, they do all these campaigns, they raise lots of money all under the banner of homelessness because no one will give money to people. If you help the drug user, No one will help them. A lot of the people who are homeless use drugs. The person, you remember your man who died in front of the Doyle? It was of a drug overdose and it was all about homelessness. That's because we ultimately don't have any. I think they're the most stigmatized group. And there's a great organization called ISHCA. You know ISHCA? It's the Drug Users Representative Organization. We're talking to. And they're specifically for service users of drug, you know, when I say service, you know, drug users. And they want to represent the drug users' perspective. And I think it's great to see organizations start that suddenly appear because we need to start destigmatizing drug use. I think that's the biggest barrier.
Definitely. I'd agree with that.
So, Austin, is that that you want to plug while you're here?
No, I suppose just GP Care for All. We're trying to develop this organisation to develop GP practice in areas of deprivation. We've one in Summerhill. We're aiming to develop one in Finglas. And then from then on, we're hoping to get to other areas of deprivation. Yeah, so that's
brilliant.
Pushing that one.
I just want to mention as well, a listener emailed us to have you on. So,
oh, wow.
To anyone else out there, if you have any other recommendations, send them on. We're all ears.
Well, thanks to your listener as well. Yeah, for pushing me.
Brilliant. Well, look, thanks for coming in and chatting with us, and keep doing the good work.
Absolutely.
The community really appreciates it.
I'll see you on the cycle next year.
Yeah. I'll go, Terry. Yeah. I'll go. Take us out, Ed.
Boom.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app. What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little.
The Hypnoka. Come down.